From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dying at Home, we talk with Andrea Sankar about why more people are taking their dying loved ones out of the hospital to spend their final days at home surrounded by the people they are closest to. Sankar is a medical anthropologist. She cared for her dying mother at home. Also today, we meet British actor Alan Rickman, best known in America for his stylish portrayals of villains. He was the head terrorist in Die Hard and the evil sheriff of Nottingham in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And TV critic David Bianculli previews two specials on the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Bush today announced his new chief of staff, Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner. The president also announced the names of his leaders of his re-election committee, although he has not formally declared his candidacy. Committee members include Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher, businessman Fred Malik, and pollster Robert Teeter. Mr. Bush also said he wants to help get the country back on its feet. He said he was speeding up more than $9.5 billion in various government payments and benefits to help spur the economy.
We cannot be complacent about people's hardships. We have good proposals outstanding on which the Congress has yet to act. But clearly we must do more. And so I intend to propose a new package of programs that will stimulate growth in the economy for both the short and the long terms.
But there was disappointing labor news this morning. The Labor Department says jobless claims are up for the third week in November. The president also said the release of hostages from Lebanon doesn't formally close the chapter on the issue. He's demanded an accounting for hostages William Buckley and Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins, two men believed to be killed in captivity. Mr. Bush said he hopes the hostage takers are eventually brought to justice. The New York Daily News today filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection after the family of late publisher Robert Maxwell asked for a kind of receivership in London. A news spokesman said the paper took legal action to protect itself against Maxwell family creditors and to get over a short-term cash flow. Maxwell's two sons, Ian and Kevin, today asked British courts to put two key Maxwell companies in the hands of outside administrators. Polish President Lech Wałęsa nominated former Solidarity leader Jan Olszewski as Poland's new prime minister, but Wałęsa immediately expressed doubt that the new premier could do the job. The parliament has been in a six-week stalemate over the premiership. Gabriel Glazer reports from Warsaw.
Wałęsa said the coalition of five right-leaning parties who support Olszewski don't have any idea how to run the economy. He said they're no more qualified to be the caretakers of the country's market reforms than Wałęsa is qualified to bake American cookies. He said, quote, it would be like me making batches of American cookies, even when I don't have any idea what goes inside them or how long they're supposed to bake. Wałęsa has pledged to continue the two-year-old reforms, which have ended lines for milk and meat, but which have left 2 million out of work. Olszewski has said they have to be adjusted to ease social discontent. The president is obligated to nominate a prime minister under the Constitution. He had wanted the incumbent premier, Jan Krzysztof Bielecki, to stay on the job, but didn't have the votes in parliament to carry it through. For National Public Radio, this is Gabrielle Glazer in Warsaw.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 22 points at 2889.53. Trading is active. This is NPR News. The woman who says William Kennedy Smith raped her returned to the witness stand today for more cross-examination. Doug Phillips reports from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Under questioning from Smith's defense attorney, Roy Black, the woman remained composed as her selective memory for details was challenged. But that composure was lost when Black's questions focused on sexual details about the alleged rape itself.
Why do you have to ask me questions like that?
Would you like to have a recess? I need to ask you some questions about this. Your Honor requests that we have a recess.
No, I will get through this. This has been a nightmare for me. I want this over.
Your Honor, I request that we have a recess.
Until that delay, Black and the woman had spirited exchanges over her testimony now and past statements to investigators. But the woman has stuck to her story that Smith forced her to have sex last March on the lawn at the Kennedy estate. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in West Palm Beach.
Prince Noordam's Sihanouk today criticized a group of American senators for trying to prevent the Khmer Rouge guerrilla group from returning to power. The prince said the senators were interfering in Cambodian affairs. Sihanouk said the Cambodian people should decide for themselves whether or not they want the group restored to power. Sihanouk was responding to reports that a letter signed by many American senators and sent to President Bush urged him to support specific measures to guard against a return to power of the Khmer Rouge. The group is blamed for the deaths of nearly a million people in the late 1970s. Kenya's opposition today began to fragment over the beginning of a political party, just 2 days after President Daniel Arap Moi permitted opposition parties in the country. Three founding members of a pro-democracy pressure group said they will turn their group into a political party to challenge the ruling Kenya African National Union. But two additional men who were named to lead the new political party say they want nothing to do with it. They say the party founders are self-seekers who don't believe in democratic process. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when the elderly and the terminally ill died at home. Over the past 50 years, advanced medical technology has offered the possibility that death could be delayed or prevented by hospitalization. But recently there's been a movement toward bringing dying loved ones back home so their remaining time can be spent outside the institutional atmosphere of the hospital or nursing home. Advances in home-based medical technology and changes in insurance reimbursement have contributed to this trend. No matter how committed you are to caring for someone at home, the responsibility can be overwhelming and frightening. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. It's based on interviews she conducted with men and women who took care of loved ones dying at home. In a little while, Sankar will tell us about her own experiences taking care of her dying mother. Sankar says part of what is involved in the decision to care for a dying person at home is the desire to allow that person to live out life in as normal a way as possible, to have the experience of living while dying.
Well, I think when people are dying at home, it gives them some sense of control over what's left of their lives. It also gives them the sense that they're still alive. I mean, when they're in the hospital, they're a patient, and when they're a patient, that means that they give up some aspects of, you know, who they are, like their ability to say no when somebody comes into the room, or their ability to wear their own clothes or eat the food they want. And they do that with the idea that they're going to get better. That's sort of a bargain they make with the hospital. But when they're at home, they don't have to give up any of those sort of aspects of personhood, because they are in their own home and they're in control again, and they're able to live out the rest of their life as much as possible.
Did you find that a lot of the people who you spoke with who had family members die at home, did you find that they had certain fears of having someone die in the house?
People who hadn't had someone die in the home were often quite frightened by it. People were often very influenced by things they'd seen on TV. I mean, they imagined that there was going to be some ghostly light appear, or a cold wind, or sometimes very irrational fears. Or they thought the death would be quite gruesome. I mean, they thought of images of Hollywood, and they were extremely frightened by that. And one of the things that a hospice, you know, a trained hospice person can do is to be there with you when the dying is taking place. There's nothing, you know, it is not a supernatural occurrence. A death is something that's within the normal range of behavior. I mean, you may not have seen a death before, but there's nothing that's going to happen that is somehow totally different from what one would expect. But not knowing what to expect or not knowing what can happen, it can be very frightening. And so one of the things I did in my book, and one whole chapter, is it consists of death narratives with the caregiver describing exactly what happened when somebody died, so that people can see that, you know, it can be very, you know, it is not that frightening. It is, however, and this is significant, it's not always the case that people slip into a coma and die in their sleep. In fact, that only happened in one case. You know, it tends to be the case that when you leave a hospital with somebody and you ask the physician, use the caregivers, ask the physician, what will happen when so-and-so dies? Physicians tend to say, oh, they'll slip into a coma and die quietly. That very rarely happens. You know, people are very often awake when they die, and they can be frightened, and you can be frightened, and there are things you can do to reassure them, you know, and make that death much more peaceful. But it's not the case that they just sort of die in their sleep.
In your book, you write that we used to know how to sit with the dying, and we're forgetting how to do that. Explain what you mean, since we still do sit with the dying, although it's often in the hospital during visiting hours as opposed to at home.
Well, what I mean by that is we don't really know how to take care of the dying. You know, we don't know what needs to be done with them. We don't know how to be the main source of comfort for them. In the hospital, you can sit there and hold their hand and talk with them, but you often are the one, you know, you often let the nurse do most of the, you know, comforting and straightening and attending. A great deal of caring for somebody who's imminently dying, say, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks of death, is simply comfort measures. It's helping them to eat what they can eat, what little they can eat. It's helping them to keep their mouth moist. It's helping them to, you know, keep their bodies clean. A lot of that is very basic nursing care. It's sitting with them when they can't sleep at night because they're frightened. It's, you know, it's maybe giving them a massage. It's things like that that people, because they've given over that sort of, you know, folk knowledge to hospitals, they don't know how to do it anymore. And those are the things people need to relearn.
Well, you know, that reminds me, when we're talking about bringing a dying person home, what are we talking about in terms of the amount of time that they have left to live and how much time you would be called on to be a full-time caregiver? And in your experience and in the experiences of the people who you interviewed, how much time did the dying person have left?
Well, you know, I should say that there are dying people who don't go into a hospital before, you know, they're not all discharged from the hospital home to die. There are people who, you know, have stayed at home most of their terminal illness. But the intense time period I'm thinking about, the period that I call active dying, is, I would say, really about 2 months. Up before that time, people can be very sick, but they often are somewhat ambulatory. I mean, they can walk, they can take care of themselves to some extent, so they don't need your intensive care. I would say 2 months is really at the outside. It's more likely 6 weeks to a month where you can be doing intensive round-the-clock nursing care. And the thing people have to remember is that when a dying person is in the hospital, they may be in an intensive care unit. They're definitely on a hospital floor where they're able to get 24-hour nursing care. When they come home, you're the person who's giving them that 24-hour nursing care. Their needs don't change. You know, one of the striking things about this experience, and it sounds a little ironic, is that the dying person is very, very sick. I mean, sicker than you can ever imagine unless you've been in that situation. And they require a tremendous amount of care.
So it really is quite a sacrifice for someone to care for a loved one at home who is dying.
It is, but I want to say two things about that. One, almost all the people, except for one person who did it, said it was probably the most important thing they'd ever done in their life. So it is a sacrifice, but it is it's extremely rewarding. The other thing I want to say is unfortunately, given the way health policy is moving, which is to have less and less care in the hospital, or to have shorter and shorter hospital stays, combined with, you know, dramatic advances in medical technology and pharmacology, so that more and more care can be given in the home, it's entirely possible that within the next 10 to 15 years, it won't be really, unless you have an acute problem, it won't be possible to die in the hospital. That whether, you know, the caregivers like it or not, the choice will be either dying at home or dying in a nursing home.
If you're just joining us, my guest is medical anthropologist Andrea Sankar. She's the author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. When you're caring for someone and that person has died, then what happens? Who do you call? Who do you call to take away the body?
One, you don't want to call 911, because if you've prepared for a home death, when you call 911, all they will do is come and try to revive the body. So many hospices suggest that you wait until the body is actually cold. Now, some people want to have the body removed right away and feel that they have to have the body removed right away and will call a funeral home and have them come out. I found in my study that if people who allowed the body to stay in the home, say 6 to 8 hours, had a much easier time saying goodbye to the person and resolving their conflicts. They treated that time, they were able to go in, be with the person, spend some time, maybe some friends came over, people who've been involved in the caregiving were able to come over and take a very intimate, personal goodbye with a person. And also, if children had been involved, children could view the body in the sort of the privacy of their home. That period, allowing that period of time, seemed to make a great deal of difference to people rather than having the body taken away immediately. after a certain point of time, they were ready for the body to leave. It wasn't like they wanted to have the body there all the time. But at a certain point, they said, okay, now it's okay for the body to go. But they did want the body to remain there for a while, and they felt much better about it. One of the benefits of having a home death is that you can make an arrangement with a funeral director before the person dies. So the funeral director is expecting you to call. And in many cases, now this varies by state, but in many cases, a physician can sign the death certificate before someone dies, and you just fill in the date so that you don't even have to have a physician come out. If the hospice nurse is there, of course, the hospice nurse can help you with all of this, but you may not have to have the physician come. You may be able to keep this just a completely private family affair, and when you feel that you have resolved, you're ready to say goodbye to the person completely, then you can call the funeral home. There's no need to rush it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrea Sankar is my guest. Now, I was interested to find that in your study of families who cared for a loved one at home, that you had a very broad definition of family. You're just not talking about blood family, nuclear family.
Absolutely, and that's an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. By family, I mean any group of people that come together and think of themselves in a very responsible, caring relationship. And this is particularly important when we're talking about HIV-positive people. Because the AIDS, people who have AIDS, those people often are estranged from their family of birth, and the people who care for them become family to them. Those are their informal caregivers, their colleagues, their lovers, their companions. And I my book is about those people too. I mean, it's about any kind of people who provide that intensive, extremely committed care to a dying person.
Now, you cared for your mother when she was dying. This was in 1987. How did you make the decision to do that?
We really didn't consider anything else. I mean, I'd worked in home care for so many years. I knew sort of what the issues would be involved, and I knew the kinds of things we could expect. And when it became clear that the hospital couldn't help her anymore, we just felt seriously that she should be at home with us. And I didn't know how difficult it was going to be, but we didn't consider any other options.
What was she dying of?
Cancer.
You say you didn't know how difficult it was going to be. What surprised you the most?
The sheer physical exertion it took. I mean, I think it's staggering. In many cases, dying people don't sleep. They don't sleep. They sleep in tiny, tiny naps. They're afraid to sleep because they're afraid they won't wake up again, so they don't want to sleep. Also, in many cases, which was the case in my family, the dying person can have brain metastases, which means that their cognitive functions are impaired. They say crazy things, and they maybe behave in a crazy way. Also, that can be an after effect of the medication, so that they can be very irascible. So that you're continually, it's very difficult to sleep. It's almost impossible to get good help to come in and work at night. That's the most difficult time to get staffing. In addition, then one of the ways, of course, that people stay alive is through eating and drinking, and that becomes more and more difficult, so that you can sit by a person's bed with a tiny baby spoon with just a drop of food on it and try to get them to eat, or try to get a little bit of liquid into their mouth so that they can live. And the dying person may really want to live. And in my case, my mother was, when she was coherent, was determined to live and wanted that, but nothing tasted good because she had so many lesions in her mouth from the chemotherapy, so that we were continually trying to find something that she could eat, something that she could drink. And it was extremely frustrating, but it would take literally hours to get maybe a little Dixie cup of food through into her.
When your mother was disoriented, were there periods that she wouldn't even recognize you?
No, she always recognized us, but she would be very angry sometimes, and then later on she would apologize. And that was very upsetting, given how much energy my family and I were putting into taking care of her. Then she would lash out at us. And that definitely is one of the aspects about taking care of a dying person, is that the social niceties tend to disappear. I mean, people are very honest. And if you can't tolerate that intense emotional intimacy and sort of raw emotions, it's probably not a good idea to be a part of this. So that whatever feelings she was having were very present, and we had to deal with that, and sometimes that wasn't so easy to deal with.
Well, what you really want in a situation like this is someone who is endlessly appreciative of the sacrifice that you're making by caring for them, not their anger.
Right, but you often get their anger, and you get the other stuff too. I mean, but there's something, there's something very refreshing about the complete honesty of it. I mean, you're at such a bare bones kind of survival, frontier almost in your life, that there's something extremely powerful about that honesty. I mean, you feel like you're in a completely different state, and you are.
Did you find yourself talking about things with your mother that you had never talked with her before?
Well, she was having enough trouble dealing with her death herself, and she was cognitively disoriented enough. I mean, there were periods when she would be immensely clear. And there were other periods when, we just couldn't talk to her. And I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry that didn't happen. I know other people did have that experience, people I interviewed, and were really able to have very deep probing discussions and clear up a whole lot of aspects of their past. And that was quite wonderful, but we didn't do that.
Did she want to die at home?
Oh, die at home? She didn't want to die at all. I mean, she wasn't really willing to accept that. She very much wanted to be home, and she was extremely grateful when she got home. And that, the relief and the pleasure in her voice when, she finally arrived at our house was really worth a lot, because she'd been in the hospital for a long time.
What were some of the difficult medical decisions you had to face when she was home?
That's one of the aspects of this whole process that is extremely important, and somehow it's difficult to talk about. You, as the caregiver, you're the person on the front line, and when somebody is that fragile, you can make the decision that could, in fact, end their life. I mean, they're so delicate. You don't know from one day to the next whether the medication you gave them, the day before is the right medication to give them, that dose is the right medication to give them now. And you could potentially do something that could end their life. And now you have support. You have nurses that you can call all the time or can come out, but they can't be there every minute. So I found myself continually making decisions that were far beyond what I considered my competence. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot very fast. But it was an incredible responsibility, and that was frightening.
Give me an example of the kind of decision you're talking about.
For instance, she would be very agitated, and she wasn't in any pain. So we would argue. My sisters would argue for the fact that she should have some medication that would reduce the medication. That if she'd been in pain, the narcotic effect would have reduced the medication. I mean, the agitation. So we would try different kinds of drugs to see what would potentially reduce her agitation. But the difficulty with trying, we tried different sleeping pills or different tranquilizers and, things like that. But the difficulty would be that we could give her something that was so strong that her body couldn't tolerate it, and potentially could reduce her ability to breathe. Or another problem would be that because of these lesions in her mouth, some of the medications we tried could cause her excruciating pain. So there was this trade-off between, on the one hand, trying to reduce her agitation so that she would be more at peace with herself, and on the other hand, worrying about the side effects that some of these medications that we gave could create. We had a very frightening thing happen soon after we brought her home to the from the hospital, in which we reduced one medication inappropriately because of some bad advice we had, and she almost died from that. And so, we were very conscious of just how delicate the balance was.
Were you with your mother when she died?
She waited. My sister and I were taking turns checking on her every 15 minutes because she'd become dramatically worse, and she waited until I had left the room and died between the time that one of us, we were out of the room. We weren't there that exact moment.
Neither of you were there?
No.
You think she wanted it that way?
Yes, I believe she did. And in fact, in almost all the cases that I interviewed, people describe similar things. Either the dying person waited until everybody was there or waited until nobody was there. They seem to be, and a lot of research seems to show that the dying person exercises some level of control over that moment.
Can I ask how you felt about her waiting until you left?
You know, the whole process, I mean, the very end of her death was so traumatic for me that I didn't particularly react to that moment. The whole last period was pretty, I think she suffered a lot in the end. And I didn't, that particular factor that she had, you know, when somebody dies, when they're that sick, it's hard to say exactly when they've died, in a sense. I know that sounds awkward, but there was a point at which her respiration stopped, but there was a process in which there was less and less of her there, and more of her had passed on to a point where she wasn't there. And it really was more of a transition than a final point. I mean, I felt a day and a half before she died, she became suddenly much more clear and, you know, alert than she'd been in weeks. And we had a wonderful talk, and we sort of all had this great talk with her, and she was like completely like herself. And I felt that was the period in which she sort of said goodbye to us. And then from then on, it was really like this transition where there was less and less of her present. And so at that exact moment didn't mean that much to me.
Do you think that it affected the mourning process for you to have been with her during the last weeks of her life?
Well, I think it affected it in two ways. One, I think I had thought I would be less grief-stricken when she died than I was because I'd been so close to the death process. And many people, you know, many people said that too. The caregivers were startled that they were so grief-stricken because they thought they were sort of dealing with their grief by being part of the caregiving, and none of us were. You know, it was very dramatic for all of us. So in that sense, it didn't help. But in the sense that it did help was that I had so many supporters, so many friends and colleagues and family members around me during this process of caregiving. That process of feeling very, very taken care of by my friends and community really helped me later in adapting to my grief.
What room did you give your mother when you brought her home?
We were fortunate. We had a study in our house, which had, you know, very large windows in it, and so we were able to put her in that room so that she had a lovely view to the outside.
How long did it take you after her death until you felt like you could use it as a study again?
Oh, maybe a few weeks. It wasn't that hard. I mean, for some people, one or two people I interviewed, it was more difficult, but it wasn't that hard for me.
Would you say that your experiences taking care of your mother brought you closer to the rest of the family, or were the difficulties such that they brought out differences and conflicts?
Well, in my family, it definitely brought us closer. I mean, I think, you know, it can go either way. It can, you know, if there's a desire to work out conflict, a situation like this can really, you know, it puts things right on the line, and it can bring a family much closer together. On the other hand, if those conflicts can't be resolved, there are many cases in my research where family members haven't spoken to each other since the death.
Hmm. Well, Andrea Sankar, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Nandra Sankar is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving, and she heads the medical anthropology program in the Department of Anthropology at Wayne State University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. American audiences know him as the terrorist with refined tastes in the movie Die Hard and the sadistic sheriff of Nottingham in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But in Europe, actor Alan Rickman is also known for his roles in the theater and independent films. Coming up, we meet Alan Rickman. This week, TV is filled with programs about the 50th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. TV critic David Bianculli has two that he recommends. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Diplomatic efforts to free the last two Western hostages held in Lebanon intensified today. The UN's top negotiator met with German leaders to discuss the latest efforts to free two medical aid workers. Heinrich Strubig and Thomas Kempner were captured in May 1989 while working with Palestinian refugees. Anna Tomford filed this report for the BBC from Bonn.
Hopes of a breakthrough for the release of the two Germans grew after talks in Bonn between Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher and the United Nations Special Envoy Gian Domenico Pico, who has been behind the complex hostage swaps now underway. The Foreign Ministry said after the meeting that there was reason for optimism that a solution could come soon. At the same time, Bonn repeated its position that it would not enter into any deals linking the hostages' release to the freeing from prison of two convicted Lebanese terrorists, Mohamed and Abbas Hamadi, serving jail terms here for air piracy and murder. But despite the denials, there can be no doubt that Germany's efforts to secure the release of the two men have now moved into higher gear, and that public pressure on the government is also growing.
Anna Tomford reporting from Bonn. Prince Norodom Sihanouk today urged the United States not to meddle in Cambodia's affairs. 55 U.S. senators have signed a letter calling for a ban on the Khmer Rouge's return to power in Phnom Penh. The guerrilla group is responsible for nearly a million Cambodian deaths. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
Prince Sihanouk's relationship with the Khmer Rouge has long been an odd, symbiotic one. When he was deposed by a U.S.-backed coup 21 years ago, he joined the guerrillas and helped them gain power. They promptly put him under palace arrest and killed 17 members of his family. But soon after he got out, he joined forces with them again and has stayed aligned with them for the past 13 years of Cambodian civil war. Today, at the Thai resort town Pattaya, he blasted an initiative by 55 U.S. senators to ban the Khmer Rouge from elections. He said American Congress has no right to treat Cambodia as a satellite and that the Khmer Rouge have the same right as any other Cambodian to run in an election. Sihanouk has now returned to Phnom Penh, where Khmer Rouge leader Khieu Samphan is also expected to return within the next few days. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
Israel today said its negotiators will be in Washington for peace talks next Monday unless it gets word that Arab parties will not attend. Israel has boycotted talks that were supposed to start up yesterday in Washington. None of the Arab delegations that turned up promised to stay, and they add that waiting until Monday is out of the question because that's the fourth anniversary of the Palestinian uprising against Israeli rule in the occupied territories. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 23 points to end the day at 2889.9. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-3 in active trading. This is NPR. President Bush today named Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner as his new chief of staff. Skinner succeeds John Sununu, who resigned on Tuesday. Presidential aides had frequently argued that Sununu had turned into a political liability for the president. Meanwhile, Mr. Bush also named Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher as chief of his reelection campaign, along with pollster Robert Teeter and businessman Fred Malik. The French company that makes the abortion pill RU486 has announced plans to conduct a major new study in Canada on the role the drug can play in treating breast cancer. The reasons why such a study would be done in Canada instead of the United States were discussed during a hearing today on Capitol Hill. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
The inventor of RU486, Etienne Balieu, told a House panel that the political climate in the U.S. is to blame for the decision to conduct clinical trials in Canada and Europe rather than the U.S. Balyeux and other witnesses played down the role that liability concerns are playing in stifling U.S. research on the abortion pill. They point instead to threatened boycotts that pharmaceutical companies face from anti-abortion activists. Subcommittee Chairman Ron Wyden says policymakers are also playing a role.
The drugs antagonists in the Bush administration, Congress, and elsewhere are going to have much to answer for. They have helped spike life-saving research for Americans in order to service their own political ends.
RU486 is now available in France and on a limited basis in Great Britain. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
A bomb exploded in downtown Belfast overnight, injuring 23 people and damaging the Grand Opera House and a nearby hotel. Police say 13 of the injured are police officers, 2 are soldiers of the locally recruited Ulster Defense Regiment, and 8 are civilians. The Irish Republican Army claimed responsibility for the blast. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Often the bad guys give the best performances in American action films. If you saw the movie Die Hard, you had to be intrigued by the sophisticated, cultured leader of the European terrorists, played by my guest Alan Rickman. And for many people, Rickman stole the show as the outrageous, evil sheriff of Nottingham in the film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Rickman has spent most of his career on the British stage. The films he's done outside Hollywood have been independent productions that have played in American art houses, like Truly Madly Deeply, Closetland, and the new film Close My Eyes. Here's a scene from Die Hard, soon after Rickman and his fellow terrorists have taken over the U.S. headquarters of a giant Japanese multinational corporation. The employees are being held hostage at gunpoint. The CEO has been taken into his office, where Rickman and his men are trying to force the CEO to provide access to the computer system.
I don't have that code.
You broke in here to access our computer? Any information you could get when they wake up in Tokyo in the morning, they'll change it.
You won't be able to blackmail our executive, threaten our profits.
Sit down.
Mr. Takagi, I'm really not interested in your computer. But I need the code key. Because I am interested in the $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds that you have locked in your vault. And the computer controls the vault.
I want money? What kind of terrorist are you?
Who said we were terrorists?
It seems that your career has almost been one extreme or another. Either you're in a big U.S. action film or a smaller European film that's in the United States likely to run in art houses.
Well, there's no plan. it's all cumulative. The only question or remark I would make about that is this insistence on people assuming that a film that's made in Hollywood for a lot of money is therefore big, and that a film made for less money but about what might be called big issues is somehow small. And it's sort of misleading, I think. From my angle, what it means is that films like Die Hard or Robin Hood allow me to make Close My Eyes, Truly Madly Deeply, Closetland.
Do you think there are differences in the way American and European directors see you and use you?
Well, the two films that I've made in England with British directors both happen to have been written by the directors as well, and I happen to have worked with them on their own work, either in the theatre or, in fact, with Anthony Minghella and Juliet Stevenson. We did one of his plays on the radio. And I guess they're more aware of my work in the theatre, so it's a slightly more complicated view of me they have. But, you know, I'm working on it over here.
I think American movie audiences were introduced to you in Die Hard, where you are the head terrorist. How did you get the part in the film?
Because I was appearing on Broadway in Les Liaisons Dangereuses, and the producer saw the film, and then I met him and the director in Los Angeles when the play closed.
Did you like action films? Was this the kind of film that you ever saw yourself in or enjoyed watching?
I have very Catholic tastes in movies, you know. I mean, I'll go and see anything if it's essentially cinematic. So you're just as likely to catch me watching not so much action movies, but actually I think Die Hard, as it turned out, became a kind of classic of its kind. It's an incredibly well-made movie in terms of its technical side and its editing and its storytelling. But that was something that we actually took care of as we were going along with it. So, you know, the process was as interesting as it could be, thanks to the director.
The character you play is someone who has the finest taste in expensive European suits and who has who is just kind of refined and upper class in every way, except for the fact that he desperately wants millions of dollars more than he has. and
like that, a lot of people.
Yeah. and of course that he's a terrorist. How did you flesh out the character when you got the script? What are some of the bits of your own that you added to the character?
Well, we had many conversations about... you see, most of the clues are there in the script. If you have somebody singing the Ode to Joy in an elevator, then that's a particular person. Or if he's quoting from Alexander the Great, it's a particular person. And so, therefore, you start to assemble how this person looks, how they behave. It seemed to me evident in the script that he didn't get his hands dirty. He had other people around to do that, and he spent most of the film talking on a, you know, what do you call it, two-way radio thing. And that if Bruce was going to present one image, then I should present the other bookend, in a sense. So that's really what we aimed for.
Die Hard was, I think, the first really expensive film, the first action film, certainly, that you made. Was there anything that really surprised you about what happened on the set or the how money was spent or anything like that?
Everything surprised me because not only was it the first action movie I'd made, it was the first film I'd made. I'd never been...
Oh, that was the very first film?
Yeah. So, you know, I was like the new kid on the block, I suppose. And everything was new and exciting and fun. And I just finished doing 6 long, hard months of Les Liaisons Dangereuses 8 times a week on Broadway, and suddenly here I was doing something where I only had 4 lines a day, and didn't matter if I got them wrong, we could do it again. So it was great.
Actor Alan Rickman is my guest. He stars in the new film, Close My Eyes. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Alan Rickman, let me ask you about another role that a lot of Americans will know you for, and that's the sheriff in Robin Hood. How did you get the part for that? Did you have to audition, or did they just give
no,
it to you?
I was asked.
Uh-huh.
And eventually I said, okay.
Why didn't you say okay immediately?
Because I couldn't believe anybody wanted to see a film about Robin Hood. Again.
What made you change your mind?
The script got funnier, so I thought, oh, well, okay, it'd be fun. And also I had just finished On the Trot, Truly, Madly, Deeply, Closet Land, and Close My Eyes, and those were all very kind of complicated, layered movies. and it seemed like it would be good to have some fun for a while.
Robin Hood steals money from my pocket, forcing me to hurt the public. And they love him for it?
Yes.
That's it. Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
It seemed like you really had fun with the part. You played the character very big. And it was very stylish characterization. You weren't going for realism, but for fun. It seemed to me. As a matter of fact, you will probably disagree with this, but you know, with Kevin Costner almost mumbling some of his lines, doing them incredibly naturalistically, you know, speaking in a really small voice, and you doing everything really kind of broadly, it almost seemed like you were in two different films. I liked yours better.
Let's talk about Close My Eyes.
Do you not want to respond to that?
There's nothing I can say. I mean, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think we were in the same film. I mean, clearly we were in the same film. It was called Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But my part had different requirements and different responsibilities, I suppose.
Were you interested in breaking into American films when, you know, before you started making movies? Was that an ambition of yours?
I guess every actor, in a sense, is a dreamer. I mean, that's part of one's makeup, I suspect. And, I guess there was some kind of fantasy there. Or, a fluffy cloud called, I'd like to be in the movies. And I guess that included America. But there was no way that one could predict it was going to happen.
Had you done anything to make it happen? Had you auditioned for other movies before you got the part in Die Hard?
There were meetings on movies. The odd film is made in England, not many, but and I'd met. But I think I always knew that it was going to be a question of being seen in something and then being given a part as a result of that, rather than going for meetings. I don't enjoy that part of the game.
What about auditioning? Are you good at that?
No, I don't like it at all. Because I don't see how you can commit yourself 100%. It's too judgmental. There's nothing to do with an actual process or discovery. You've got to prove something very quickly, now, or look right, you know, and most of the time it's a question of what you look like. You walk in the room and they've already made a decision. But having said that, I'm a man, and however bad it might seem to me, it's a million times worse for women.
When you've auditioned in movies, have you auditioned opposite an actor or a casting director?
Well, I've never really auditioned. I've just been in and met a director. I haven't really read for anything much. It doesn't tend to work like that in England.
So
you kind of go in and meet, and then they're either interested or they're not.
Do you try to be the character when you have a meeting with somebody? So that you can convince them that you could play that character?
No, there's a kind of devil in me that refuses to do that. I don't like the idea of having to go in dressed up as the character that you want to play. That's like prostitution.
In the sense that it doesn't respect the real process of acting?
Exactly.
So what kind of roles do you have coming up now?
I've just been doing a film in Pittsburgh, which will be coming out in the summer, I think, which is a film that's been directed and written by Tim Robbins, and he's also playing the lead, which I suppose...
Is this the player?
No, he's finished that. It's called Bob Roberts, and it's, I suppose it's, if you know the film The Candidate, it would be a cross between that and Spinal Tap, if you know that film.
Huh.
So it's very much, I hesitate to say the phrase political satire, but I guess that's what it is. It's done as a kind of documentary, but it's very funny too, and it's the story of the terrible rise of a very right-wing pop singer as he gets elected to Senate. And so I play his campaign manager. I've just finished working on that, and before that, I was doing a play in the West End in London, which is the first play I'd done for 4 years, so that was kind of alarming. And I'm going to take that to Japan for a month after Christmas.
I guess being British limits the options that you have in American movies.
Well, the character I just did was American, so it remains to be seen, I suppose.
Did you use an American accent?
I had to, yeah.
Do you find that hard to do? I think Americans are always surprised when an English person speaks American, although Americans always pride themselves on being able to do a British accent, but they can't hear their own accent.
No, and I'm sure that mine will probably sound as ridiculous to you as most Americans' idea of a British accent sounds to me. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see when the movie comes out and I find I've been dubbed.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Alan Rickman stars in the new film, Close My Eyes. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, as Terry Anderson is examined in Wiesbaden, Germany, we'll be talking with David Jacobson, former hostage too, who shared a room with Anderson for years. He says the United States, regardless of any arrangement it might have made to free Anderson and Sisipio and the rest, should go ahead, try to indict and arrest the people responsible for these hostages being held in Lebanon for so long. Also today, as the 50th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor approaches, we consider the debate that ended with Pearl Harbor and talk with people who were part of that debate over whether the U.S. should enter the Second World War.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Just about everywhere you look this week, there are remembrances of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of two TV specials about the attack. Saturday night's Remember Pearl Harbor, hosted by veteran CBS newsman Charles Kuralt, and a program that airs tonight on ABC called Pearl Harbor, 2 Hours That Changed the World, hosted by David Brinkley.
For those who remember it, December 7, 1941 was a date so burned into our minds that we will always remember where we were and what we were doing when we heard about it. For those too young to remember, it helped create the world we now live in, whether we remember it or not or realize it or not. It was the end of one world and the beginning of another.
There are so many Pearl Harbor specials floating around this week, there's a temptation to just go into sensory overload and skip them all. But don't. Because both of these documentaries are worth watching. And they're interesting not only because of what they say about Pearl Harbor, but because of their similarities and differences in telling essentially the same story. Both of these network shows are like the answer to a riddle. What do you get if you cross World War II with the Civil War? That's because both CBS and ABC have stolen the playbook of PBS and styled their shows like the Ken Burns documentary, The Civil War. Still photographs and period music are used, along with quotes from letters that are read by off-screen actors. But of course, Ken Burns didn't have newsreels to rely on, or radio tapes to preserve the voices, and he certainly didn't have eyewitnesses from both sides. The CBS and ABC programs do, and they make very good use of them. Tonight's ABC documentary is co-produced by Japan's NHK television network, which, given the subject, is nicely symbolic in its own right. Maybe because of that, the ABC program does a better job of explaining Japan's attitudes toward America and Americans, and of getting Japan's point of view of the actual attack. ABC also makes a bigger deal of its recreation of the attack, a segment that relies heavily on a mixture of newsreel footage and a subsequent documentary reenactment by filmmaker John Ford. CBS takes a balanced approach too, but there are differences in the way the two networks treat the various elements of the attack. CBS, for example, spends a lot of time on the Japanese submarine crew, while ABC dismisses them as superfluous and an actual irritation to the rest of the Japanese forces. So how do the two shows match up? Brinkley and Kuralt are about as good as TV gets, so the networks are evenly matched there. ABC has better footage, especially from Japan. CBS does a better job getting name actors to contribute their voices and of recreating the Civil War style of documentary storytelling. ABC has George Bush as a guest, but CBS has an even more powerful secret weapon, retired General H. Norman Schwarzkopf. Schwarzkopf not only co-hosts the CBS program, but appears throughout the documentary in the role of military analyst and war historian, getting into the minds of leaders from both sides and doing an absolutely terrific job of it. Here's a sample of what the CBS show sounds like. This segment starts with Kuralt talking about Japanese Fleet Commander Yamamoto, then has Richard Dreyfuss as the voice of Yamamoto, followed by commentary from the former commander of Operation Desert Storm.
He had evolved into a cool and daring commander, and now his searching mind gave birth to an astounding plan. Japan's one best hope to defeat the Americans he knew so well. If it could be made to work.
We should do our very best at the outset of the war with the United States to decide the fate of the war on the very first day.
He was a brilliant man. He was a great strategist. It's interesting, when you read about Yamamoto, Yamamoto never thought Japan was going to win the war. You know, he was given a job to do by his country, and when given this job, he tried his best to come up with a strategy that would allow him to accomplish the mission.
In Remember Pearl Harbor, Schwarzkopf dominates the documentary just as easily and forcefully as he dominated press briefings during the Gulf War. Basically, Schwarzkopf is to Remember Pearl Harbor what Shelby Foote was to the Civil War. Don't miss him, and don't miss either of these Pearl Harbor anniversary specials.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock, Sue Weinstein, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Peter Medak, director of such films as The Ruling Class, The Craze, and the new film Let Him Have It. Medak was born in Hungary. His father was imprisoned by the communist government. After Medak escaped from the country, he worked with David Lean in England and worked on American TV productions like The Alfred Hitchcock Hour and The Virginian. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.